So here I am in the Adishtana Library with Akasha Shuri. Thank you very much, Akasha Shuri, for finding the time to have a conversation.
Pleasure. A joy. Thank you for asking.
So I wanted to start off by asking you, where did it all start for you, the spiritual life, the Dharma journey?
Well, my Dharma journey started when I was training as a Gestalt therapist and a psychosynthesis therapist in Holland. And one of my teachers was Vajrayogini. I didn't know she was a Buddhist. She wasn't calling herself Vajrayogini. But part of the course was that you had to go for 3 weeks to Spain, where she was living part of the year at El Bloque near Cujiloca. And you had to be there for 3 weeks. That was part of the course. And I went there and she taught us the Metta Bhavana. And the first Metta Bhavana, well, I was completely blown over. And that was it. I thought, oh, well, if that is a way of living, I quite like to live that way. And I asked her, you know, where did she learn that meditation? And then she was telling me about the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, as it was still then. I think it was 3 months later, I went on my first retreat in Spain at El Bloque with Subhuti on the Wheel of Life. And the other person that was there was Chittapala and Samatan Surata. And that was it, and I never turned back.
Gosh, and what year would that have been?
That would have been 1985, yeah, when I was 31 years old. So soon after that, I decided to give up my job, change my life, and packed up my flat and moved to Spain to live at El Bloque with Vajrayogini. And so then I got to know the guys from Cujiloca very, very well because the circumstances at Cujiloca were really sort of severe at that time. Mm. They had hardly anything to eat. There was no heating. They came once a fortnight to El Bloque to do all their washing, to have a few proper meals. And then we send them off with pots of peanut butter, hazelnut pasta to put on your bread. And that's how I got to know the guys from Cujiloca. Atadarshin was one of them, Dharmapala, Dharmavira, Mokshananda.
So were they building Cujiloca at that point?
They were still building Cujiloca at that point. Oh. Yeah.
And what was El Bloque? I've heard of it, but
El Bloque was a new age centre, and it was set up by Vajrayogini and her son. So we would run courses for a week or a fortnight. It could be anything from a dream workshop or Feldenkrais or 2 weeks Gestalt or an FWBO retreat or bioenergetic. So people would come mainly from Holland and Belgium to follow those courses, and then a bit like running a retreat centre, but we weren't part from one FWBO retreat. It was mainly courses that we ran. So there was about between 9 and 12 of us running that place. Most of us were therapists, so we would do part of the program ourselves. And then a few times a year we had programs for English-speaking people, and one of them was retreat from the FWBO. Yeah, that was it.
So Vajrayogini was the first order member you met?
She was.
Can you tell me a bit about her? I've heard about her, but I don't know anything about her.
People tell me she was a formidable woman, and I think she was. I think Benti named her extremely well. She was very tall, big woman, not fat, but a big woman, and a bit sort of stylish. What's the word in English?
Say it in Dutch.
Well, that's gone as well. chic. Mm. Anyway, and she was very fierce. She would just tell you whatever she thought. She was very, very direct, and but actually she was very exceptional. She was the best Gestalt teacher in Holland and Belgium. She was trained by the original Gestalt teacher, Fritz Perls, and by the first people who were trained in psychosynthesis by Asa Joly. So, you know, when, in a way, in the early 60s, she travelled all the way to America to, what's it called, Esalen Center. That was the New Age center at that time, to get trained as a Gestalt therapist. So we hit it off, actually, from day one. And although there was an age difference of nearly 40 years, we established a very, very deep friendship, which was both ways. Really, she's been perhaps one of the most influential people in my life. Yeah. Not just because he was my Gestalt teacher and my psychosynthesis teacher, but also because I got to live with her for 3 years and she introduced me to FWBO. So, you know, you can imagine she was a major influence on my life. Yeah. It's interesting, the first teacher, because Subhuti was my other first teacher. And then later on, Vajrayogini became one of my KMs, together, one of my Kalyana Mitras, together with Samatha. And then after Vajrayogini had died, I really wanted another Kalyana Mitra. And I felt it had to be somebody who had known me and Vajrayogini, and who I still had a rapport with in terms of Kalyana Mitrata. So I asked Subhuti, because he knew her very well and he'd known me for years. So then he became my KM and Samatha again a few years ago. And in a way, that felt so important. It was also like still honouring my special relationship with Vajrayogini.
So you had another Kalyana Mitra ceremony with both of them?
Yeah. I had one 6 years after my ordination in 1990 with Samatha and Vajrayogini, and then maybe 5 years ago with Samatha and Subhuti.
Do you remember your first impression of Subhuti on that first retreat?
It was fantastic. He'd just come from Greece, where he'd written his book, The Buddhist Vision, which, of course, is about the wheel of life and a little bit about the spiral. And he talked, well, you know, Subhuti can talk a lot. He talked non-stop about the wheel of life. So we had sessions starting in the morning at 10:30, lasting till 1. And then another session in the afternoon from about, because imagine it's Spain and it's hot in the afternoon. So the afternoon session started from 5 till 7:30. And then we had another session in the evening. But then it was usually meditation and puja. But Subhuti talked non-stop, totally inspired about the wheel of life. And I still got my notes about that. So that's 1985. Yeah. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Sounds fantastic. Yeah. So do you remember the point at which you asked to join the order?
I do, because I'd left Spain 3 years after I've been living there. And I came to London to find out whether I wanted to be part of the FWBO, whether I wanted to ask for ordination, whether this is what I wanted to do with my life. And I arrived in London 1990 with a rucksack and a small bag. And I thought Samatha would still be there. She was the only person I knew in London. But she just moved to Cambridge. So the only other person I knew in London was Vimoksha Lehi. She wasn't ordained then. And I went to the London Buddhist Centre to ask for her address, and I knocked on her door or rang the doorbell, and it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and she was in her pyjamas, and she was, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm looking for a bed because I've got no money. I don't know where to go. Help." And she said, "Okay." She said, "Well, that's okay. I'm on a night shift, so I'm just getting up, so you can be in my bed in the night. By the time I get home at 7:30 in the morning, you have to get up because then I need to sleep." So we did that for a fortnight. Anyway, and then I went around all the businesses that were around the LBC asking for a job. And in the end, I got a job at the London Buddhist Centre as a cleaner and on reception with my Treya Bendu together. Of course, he wasn't ordained then either. And then I think I'd been living around the LBC for about maybe 2.5 months. And then I wrote a long letter to Benti asking for ordination. I remember it well because it was a letter of 13 pages.
Goodness me.
Yes. That was 1991. Yeah. No, that was 1990. And then there was only one Dharmacharini actually working in the London Buddhist Centre. That was Varbhadri. And I thought, well, if I was serious about ordination, this wasn't going to speed up, was it? It was only one Dharmacharini at the London Buddhist Centre. So then I found out about Tarloka because there were many order members there. So I asked whether I could come and live there. And the rest is history, as you say, in England. So I moved there a few months later and got ordained 2 years later and lived at Tarloka for 5.5 years.
Mm. So it was 2 years from
asking
when you came to be ordained.
Yeah.
That seems quick.
It's quick, but I tend to say to people, I think I've done quite a lot of integrating work by doing my training as a Gestalt therapist, as a psychosynthesis therapist, because then you have to sort of go through everything yourself. So I think by the time I really got serious involved with the movement, I knew pretty well myself. I knew myself pretty well. Of course, I got more surprises later on. But I knew myself well enough to sort of think, oh, yeah, yeah.
I guess you could say you've done a lot of the work of integration. And
that's it.
It sounds like there's a lot of positive information there.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And you'd had 3 years living with your, well, who became your KM, Vajra Yogini.
Yeah, there was that too, yeah, yeah.
What was that like, living with her?
Living with her was a challenge. It was a real challenge because she was somebody, she didn't like talking about, frivolous speech. She did not do frivolous speech. She just didn't know how to do that. And I had to learn not to do frivolous speech. So I suppose in those 3 years, I put my life, I don't know how you say it in English, but at her service, because she was getting older and there's quite a few things she couldn't do anymore. So, and in a way, she was also looking for a kind of a companion. You know how Benti usually has a companion, the Buddha has a companion, and Vajra Yogini was looking for a companion, and not many people found her easy because she was very strong-willed. She spoke her mind, she knew what she wanted. But actually, I don't know. I never really found her difficult. I could see why she could be difficult for other people, but actually we hardly ever had issues to sort out. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Mm. She was quite a character then. Say if there was a bit of a feast at Alblocker at the end of a course, then of course the music would go loud and people would drink a bit here, there, and then she would always dress up in these long dresses, you know, white long dresses, and then she would let her hair down, because usually it was nicely done up with a clip, but then she would let it down, and she would dance as if she was a teenager. She was really wild. She was quite a character, quite a character. I think one of the stories she was telling me was that on her first retreat, she met Sangharakshita, and it was Vajradhaka who introduced her to the order and movement. And she had an interview with Benti, and she said to him, "Look, now, I'm very sort of down to earth, so don't expect me to bow for a Buddha image. That's not what I'm going to do." She just told Benti, just, you know, straight in his face. And Benti looked at her and she said, "Well, okay, if you don't want to bow, you don't bow." And then later on, Vajrayogini was telling me, the last morning of the retreat, she entered the shrine room and her body bowed. And she realized that it was her head that had been saying, "I'm not going to bow for a Buddha Rupa," but her body was naturally bowing, and since then it was never an issue again. She was very faithful disciple of Bente, very.
So I picked that up because I had a sense, actually, like you were saying, your Gestalt training, psychosynthesis training, was in a way part of your ordination process before you'd ask for ordination.
Yes.
But also you'd been there in her service, living and working with her very intensely by the sound of it.
She's just as, till the last day of her life, I was with her then. By then she'd moved back to Holland. She was always grateful to Benti, and, you know, she has her own terminology for introducing her to higher states of consciousness. Mm. Yeah, that was her, that and the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, higher states of consciousness, and the Metta Bhavana. I don't think she knew any more Dharma than that. You didn't have to ask her anything else, but she could tell you anything about the Four Noble Truths from experience. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's quite Orman. Mm.
So we've got to you being at Taraloka, and then you were ordained. Mm. Were you ordained at Taraloka?
I was not. I was ordained at Dhanakosha. We were the 1 year, the years before people the women got ordained at Taraloka. But then there wasn't enough space at Taraloka's program anymore to run and the GFR retreats and an ordination retreat. And Tiratnaloka didn't existed yet. So Dhanakosha was so kind to put on a fortnight for us. In the end, we had a 10-day retreat. And there were 12 of us who got ordained there. And was snow, frost, snow, snowstorms, frost, snow. It was fantastic. It was really mythical up there.
That was November, wasn't it?
November. It was November. And I got ordained, or I was ordained, by Ratnasuri. She was my private preceptor. And I'd been living with her for 2.5 years. So I knew her very well, and she knew me very well. And then Sangadevi was my public preceptor, and I'd also been living with her at Taraloka. So,
And so it's Ratnasuri who gave you your name.
Yes. It took a while to get used to it, because I'd never heard the word Akasha before. This is a little confession. By the time I was ordained, I'd never done any Mitra study. But that's a whole other story. So I'd never heard the word Akasha, so I didn't really pick it up in my private ordination. But I picked up on the word Shuri and I thought, oh, that will do. I've got the same part of the same name as Ratnashuri, so that's fine. And then luckily she gave me a little piece of paper with my name on it and what it meant. So I was very grateful for her that she'd written it down. So she gave two different, a short and a longer meaning for the name. So the short name was Heroine of Space, and the long name was Heroine of Boundless Space and Limitless Light.
Wow.
It's a bit like a Akashavana, Forest of Luminous Space. So you've got luminosity and spaciousness together. So the Akasha is the space that illumines from within. So that's why it got both aspects in it. It's been something to live up to. The Shuri bit is okay. I've got enough Shuri. But the Akasha bit has been the practice. So she knew me very well to know that my sort of default position would be anxiety. So I could do with a little bit more Akasha, which I'm glad to say I've made progress on that one. Yeah. So that was 1993.
1993. 25 years ago. Oh, so you're 25 this
November. I'm 25 in November. Yeah. Never regret a single day of my involvement with the Order or Movement. Never, ever. No.
So on that day, 25 years ago, Ratnashuri introduced you to your Yidam as well?
She did. Yes. She, in those days, you weren't given the sadhana during the ordination retreat. It was too short. So we were given a mantra during the private ordination. And then she introduced me to Vaitara's Mayidam back home. That was easy, of course, because I was living with her. So Vaitara came into my life without me knowing who she was, and before I'd heard anything about bodhisattvas. So we still have to go back to the time that I was living at El Bloque. And there was one winter, we would close down for the winter in mid-October till mid-December. And the director of El Bloque with his wife, they wanted to go away for 3 weeks. So I had offered to look after the place for 3 months. Sorry, they wanted to be away for 3 months. So I said, okay, then I'll stay here and I'll look after the place. And when they came back, they'd gone traveling in India and Nepal. They brought a tanka with them. And Dolph was his name. He said, I saw this tanka and I knew it had to go to you. And I said, oh, well, it looks beautiful. But it didn't mean anything to me. But anyway, it was given to me. So I put it at the end of my bed. And it's been there ever since. She never left. She never left. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. She's a constant companion, although I've got a new companion since 2 years, and that's Manjugosha. So at the moment, I'm doing both practices. Yeah. But I suppose, like, you know, because I've been doing Vaitara Sadhana for so long, she's just, it doesn't take much to feel her presence. I think it's your practice as well, isn't it?
Yeah. I do the practice, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I had quite some even before, again, before I knew, really knew who she was, there was a year in 1987, I just became interested in Buddhism. And I found myself in Kalimpong and I got really, really ill. You know, 40 degrees fever for days on end. And the doctor had been to see me in the hotel room and he said to my partner then, you know, tomorrow, she really had to go to the hospital in Gangtok in a helicopter and then we need to get her to Gangtok Hospital. And my partner was telling me that and I thought, oh no, in an Indian hospital, I think you might go in alive, but you probably don't get out alive. And I remember that afternoon falling asleep and really, really this kind of feverish sweating for hours. And I woke up at 4:30 and the sun was going down. And I had this amazing dream of Waitara and I knew she was in the room and I knew I was better. What I didn't know was that Waitara was one of Dado Rinpoche's major practices. But of course, I didn't know who Waitara was. And I didn't know I found myself in the same town as Dado Rinpoche in Kalimpong. But so in different periods in my life, she's just somehow been present, quite strongly present without me interfering or, you know, doing anything. Yeah.
So when you look back at that time and you remember the dream, you realise it was Waitara,
yeah.
But you didn't realise at the time.
No.
In the dream, it was an image or a figure.
Well,
or
yeah, she was white and she had the eyes and, you know, all that. Yeah.
But you didn't know who it was?
No, no idea. No. Mm-hmm.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Love at first sight. I remember getting my invite for my ordination and Ratnasuri said to me, are you happy? And I said, well, I'm really happy because now Waitara will always be able to find me. Don't know where that came from, but that was my first response. Or I will always be able to find her, however you want to look at it. Yeah.
And that's been your experience?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask you how you describe your sort of day-to-day, week-to-week practice. Sounds like she's an integral part of that. But I don't...
Meditation or...?
Well, broadly, really. In any, how would you... You could say... Well, if somebody would say, how what does your... Dharma practice look like?
What does my Dharma practice look like? I think service is an important part of it. And as soon as I notice that, you know, I've been living in communities for 30 years now, but I still can find myself walking past the sink and thinking, I'm not going to wash up. It's somebody else's turn. And as soon as I think that, I go back and wash up. Yeah, so it's just, well, I suppose the practice of not putting myself first. I think that's the main, if anything, that's my main practice. And not looking around, is everybody doing an equal part the same way as I do? Or so being of service and... yeah, giving freely. Yeah. So in a way, that also, what I've learned from it, it doesn't really matter what I do. Whether I need to write a text for a website for Metta Vihara or whether I need to go and clean the Buddhist centre or whether I need to go and ordain someone in Spain next month. It's, in a way, it's all the same. It's for me, there is no difference. I remember living at Trialoka and I was sent to Shrewsbury for the first time to do shopping. And I had to find particularly what do you call it, a tea sieve?
Tea strainer.
I had no idea where to look because I didn't know English shops. So what would be a shop where you could buy a tea strainer? And I was walking down the streets in Shrewsbury, and there was this one moment, because I got a bit sort of, how am I going to find a shop with a tea strainer? I don't even know the word in English. What am I going to do? And I could find myself tightening up, feeling anxious. And then I realised I was buying a tea strainer for Sangharakshita, because it was his movement. And I completely relaxed. And in a way, I still feel like that. It doesn't matter who does what in this order and movement, as long as things get done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So my life has been very varied in the order and movement. And in a way, I suppose if one stops picking and choosing, life is a lot easier and happier. Let's put it that way. Yeah, yeah.
You were saying you've worked full-time for the movement almost continuously since 1990?
Yeah, since I moved to England. I was in England for 13 years, 1990 till 2003. So I went from the London Buddhist Centre, cleaning and reception, to 5.5 years Tailoka, then helping in Manchester, the new Buddhist Centre, setting up a shop. That was 3 years. Then I took a year out. Then they needed people at Tiratnaloka. So then I went to Tiratnaloka to the support team there for 3 years. And then I was asked to go back to Holland to help setting up things there, which I've done ever since. So, yeah.
Although you did say you had a spell driving a van for Windhorse Trading.
Yeah, well, yeah, there was that too. So I arrived in Holland, and then after 6 months we decided to see whether we could get our own retreat centre off the ground. So we formed a council, and took 9 years. Fundraising, having an ID, fundraising, getting people behind it, finding a place, building it, the whole thing, 9 years of my life. Well, not just me, you know, but I've been involved till it opened. And then I lived in Amsterdam and helped at the Amsterdam Buddhist Center. No, that's not true, actually. After Metta Vihara, I didn't have a job when Metta Vihara opened. So then I was asked to help Windhorse with being a van driver in Holland and Belgium, which I did. Artur Mitra asked me whether I wanted to come and help him. So then I was a van driver for 3 years in Holland and Belgium, which I really enjoyed.
So what did that involve?
It involved driving up and down the country and then the north of Belgium, just visiting shops. So we had our regular customers, and we would phone them up and say, would you like a visit of the van this month or next month? And then you would make a schedule and then drive up and down the country and try to sell the goods. And then when Windhorse closed down, I had a spell of a year and a half working in the world, which was strange after so many years since 1990. And then about 2 years ago, the Sangha in Holland and Belgium asked me whether I wanted to work again full-time for Triratna. They fundraised for me, and that's what I'm doing at the moment. So I'm dividing my time between Arnhem Buddhist Centre, the Amsterdam Buddhist Centre, and Metta Vihara. So life is wonderful. I get to see many people go many places. and just serve the order in movement. Yeah. And I get better with it. I get happier.
You get happier?
Yeah. 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 It's good. It's a good life. Mm.
And you were saying earlier, you were quite clear when they asked if you wanted to work for the movement full time again, what you'd need. And you said that you needed to be supported for 5 years.
Yes. Yes. So I had this job. By the time I had this job, I was 61 years old when Windhorse closed down. And the next day I was offered a job by somebody in Amsterdam. So I'd been doing that job for a year and a half for a publishing house. And then the Sangha asked me whether I wanted to work for Tri Ratna again. And I said, yeah, I would love to, but you need to fundraise enough money for 5 years till my pension. Because at my age, it's not going to be easy to find another job again. And I need to work till I'm 67. So I said, OK, I need 8,000 euros a year times five. So you need to fundraise for 40,000 euros. And once you've got that, I'll stop my job. And I just thought it was early April. I'll give them till the end of the year and then we'll see how much money they've got. And then within 3 weeks, they had the money. So that was a bit of a shock. That was a bit of a shock. And then I had to talk to my boss and said I was going to leave, which he didn't like. So I stayed a bit longer with him because he'd been kind to me as well. So now I've been working again full time for the Order in Movement since October 2 years ago.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that at some point you had a year completely out of things.
Yes.
How did that come about and what was that about?
By the time I was leaving Manchester, because I have a lot of energy, but also I can be very driven. That's the drawback of having a lot of energy. And I think in Manchester I came to a point where, well, you could say I'd overdone it, done too much. So I helped to set up the community, was part of the council, worked at a Buddhist centre for a while, did Mitra studies, started a shop with Maitri Nandi, became chapter convener, KM to a few people. And then after 3 years, I realized I needed to go about things a different way. So I decided to have a year out, partly to look at that habit, but also to see who I really was without the Tri Ratna institutions. So if I wasn't an order member, if nobody knew I was a Kashuri, if I didn't do Mitra study and all that, who was I and what did I believe without that context? And for some reason, those two things together made me decide it was good to have a year out. And then the third reason was that whilst Vajrayogini was still alive, I still wanted to spend more time with her. So I went back to live with her in Spain for a year in 1999 at El Bloque. And to explore again myself and my relationship with the institutions, the order and the movement. But the interesting thing was after 3 weeks, I realized, well, life is still the same. I'm still meditating. I'm still trying to be ethical. I'm still reading Dharma every day. I'm not working in the institutions. I'm working at El Bloque again because I had to support myself. But in a way, not much has changed. But because I really wanted to also to spend more time with Vajrayogini, I stayed at El Bloque for a whole year. And then Samatha asked me to come and help out at Tri Ratna Loka. So then after that year, I went back full-time into the institutions of the order and movement. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. So a very important strand that runs through all this is your connection with Bante.
Yeah, very much so.
Do you remember when you first met him?
Yes. I was in London and I was just made a Mitra. I was made a Mitra in Spain by Vasantra, because he was then living at Cuculoca. He made me a Mitra. And I'd been around the London Buddhist Centre for 3 months and I'd written my letter asking for ordination. And then I asked to see Bente and I was very naive. My English wasn't very good. And I went to see him and it was boiling hot in the room because he liked the heat. It was midsummer, it was July, and the sun was glaring at the window panes and I was dripping with sweat. And he was sitting there with a T-shirt and a sweater and a woolen jumper and slippers, and I couldn't believe it, I remember one thing about the conversation, and that was that I said, I was going to live at Taraloka, and I was pretty nervous about it because I didn't know anybody there. And he looked at me and he said, "I'm sure you will enjoy it, otherwise you would not have asked to go there." That was the end of my worry, going to live at Taraloka. I think I'm by nature a faith type, and I've only met Bente twice, one-to-one, but I've written to him maybe on average 6 times a year ever since, and I've never really felt the desire or the need to go and see him. I feel I'm so surrounded by Kalyana Mitrata that I never felt the desire to develop a strong personal connection with him in terms of meeting him often. But actually, he's in my life every day. I've done the Kalyana Mitra yoga after my ordination for 10 years every day together with the Vaitara Sadhana. He's just in my life every day. When I get up, it's one of the first things that my mind turns to. I'm just grateful. I'm grateful for what he started, what he's given us. And I think I still see most of the things I do that is of being of service to him. And of course, there has been a lot of talking and issues here, there that needed to be looked into. It hasn't affected me and my relationship with Sankarachita. I'm sorry for other people who have issues and feel pain or whatever the word is, but for some reason or other, I'm just grateful for what we've got, what Bente given to the world. It's extraordinary. Of course one makes mistakes. I've made many mistakes in my life and I hope people forgive me and I hope I will forgive other people, you know, for things that we might not have done as well as we could. And, the same for Sangharakshita, you know. Well, personally, I don't feel there is anything I need to forgive him for. I think I'm a faith type and it suits me well. It can have a drawback that I'm not, perhaps at times, not thinking things through enough, not being critical. But actually, that's just my nature. My nature is to serve and feel grateful. Yeah.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
What a gift to the world we've got. It's an amazing gift. Where do you find this? That all we want is kindness. You know, and give kindness to others and other people give kindness to us. The fact that Bhante taught the Metta Bhavana is a miracle. It's a miracle. It's the best gift we can have in this world. If everybody did the Metta Bhavana, well, perhaps even once a week, the world would be a different place. Yeah. So I feel grateful and faithful to my teacher.
Mm.
Yeah. And all the other people that have given to me. Yeah. Mm.
So I was going to ask you, thinking about the centrality of going for refuge, and as we say, what does it mean to you? And I'm wondering if you've just answered that or if there's something more you'd say about that.
I suppose if you ask me about the centrality of going for refuge, then I immediately think of the Bodhisattva ideal. And then I think, well, how can I put that into practice? And I suppose having faith in my teachers and being of service is my way of putting it into practice. I'm not a scholar. You know, I can lead study, but I'm not a particularly good study head. I know enough Dharma. But for me, the Bodhisattva ideal is about action.
Mm.
An action of kindness, an action of help, watching my mind when I'm turning towards unhelpful criticism or thinking about poor me. For me, that's all going for refuge. It's just putting the Bodhisattva ideal into practice. And I'm not a meditation teacher. I'm not very good up front. I'm good at friendship, developing friendship, Kalyana Mitrata, connecting with people. And I think that's how I serve. That's how I serve the Bodhisattva ideal.
Thank you.
That must be it.
I think it is.